يوسف جلالي بتهران.
روباشافيت غازا.
جيروم هيوز بروسلز.
سعيد بورزا لندن.
رشا سغلام اسطنبول.
سيد امين علمي كابول.
شاهان بات انديان ادمنستريد كشمير.
Around the world with reporters.
A private workshop in Kabul, where over 50 women are working and being trained, has provided a place for women to learn making different handicrafts. These women are producing stunning artifacts, despite the problems they stumble upon.
We produce traditional clothing such as leather purses and shoes, hats, carpets and traditional dresses. We used to earn a living previously, but now our sales have decreased and most families face economic problems as a result.
Fereshta Hashemi, the woman who launched this place, says more and more women are showing interest in private workshops because restrictions imposed by the Taliban has deprived them from social activities.
Previously, the schools and universities were open to women, but now, as a result of the restrictions on women, girls cannot go to school and female teachers have lost their job, which is why they show interest in learning a profession so they could work in the future and earn a living.
Lida, one of the trainees in this workshop, was a teacher when the Taliban banned women from education and women teachers lost their jobs. She says maybe in the future this profession helps her earn a living.
Previously, I was a teacher and I lost my job. I wanted to learn a profession, so I came here. I am learning leather crafting now and hope to run my workshop someday to earn a living.
When the Taliban took control of the country in 2021, they banned women from education and gradually from most of the jobs in the country. Even most female-dominated professions like women's hairdressing salons were closed a week ago.
Women in Afghanistan are taking refuge in small businesses not only to provide for their families, but also to get relieved from the mental pressure of being restricted from education and the other jobs they used to do. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
From Vermont to Texas, desperately needed coronavirus-era social programs are ending in the United States. On August 1st, many areas ended their moratoriums on debt to landlords, meaning nearly a million children are now at risk of eviction in the city of Los Angeles alone. Families have the highest risk of losing their home, while half of those saying they expect to be evicted are Black or Latino. Evictions in the United States have recently soared to reach double what they were before the pandemic.
Lost our jobs because of the pandemic. Lost everything we had because of the pandemic. We found a place to live with a buddy in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but he died, and that was in March. And so we decided to come out here because we thought there would be more opportunities. We're just hoping to get jobs and get into a place to live and get a car and function. And that, so far, we've been struck out. As you can see, we're packing our bags. We're going back to Colorado.
America's decentralized model of federalism makes a nationwide approach to the evictions wave impossible. Public camping is illegal in many places, like Texas, which makes it harder for charity workers to find and help the homeless.
I had a stroke, and I was bleeding on the brain, and, you know, I had to go to rehab a lot to learn how to walk and talk again and all that. I've only been homeless like a year and a half. I went to Cornerstone Shelter, Sarah Circle Shelter, and now I'm in a tent. But I got a caseworker, I went to church, and the Cornerstone supervisor told me I popped up on her computer and I got, you know, she's got housing for me.
Other vital social services are also being withdrawn. Millions of Americans, including children and new mothers, just lost their medical coverage for the first time in 3 years after Washington refused to extend the pandemic-era program. College tuition debt represents an incredible 7% of U.S. GDP. In October, 41 million Americans will have to start repaying an average of $400 per month, and many say this alone could push the country into a recession. A lack of affordable housing is something that any committed government can easily fix by writing laws which favor tenants instead of rich landlords, by putting more tax revenue into building more public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations she was stealing the Quran from the activists. Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defense of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian welcomed his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Mehrdad in Tehran on Monday. The visit is aimed at boosting bilateral ties at various regional and international levels. It follows a historic trip by the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the Arab state back in May.
One of our common priorities is to follow up on the agreements between the presidents of the two countries during the recent visit of Dr. Raisi to Damascus. In the past weeks, with the efforts of the ambassadors of the two countries, we have seen progress in the implementation of economic, commercial, and technological agreements between the two countries.
The two diplomats also explored avenues for advancing commercial and economic collaboration. Both Tehran and Damascus are actively pursuing de-dollarization in their trade transactions, aiming to reduce reliance on the greenback.
We've agreed that business transactions between Iran and Syria will be done with the national currency of the two countries.
Countering destabilizing elements in the region, notably the Zionist regime, was another line of discussion. The Syrian foreign minister emphasized the destructive impact of the Israeli regime, reflecting the side's joint commitment to addressing such challenges.
What we are witnessing today in the Zionist entity and regime, the depth of the crisis, that it is an illegitimate regime. Its main objective is occupation and the building of settlements at the expense of lands of others. The indigenous people of this land, of the land of Palestine, or the people of Palestine.
During their bilateral dialogue, the focus also centered on the contentious issue of the illegal U.S. military presence in Syria, widely perceived as a primary catalyst for regional terrorism.
Iran and Syria are two long-time allies whose joint record in the fight against terrorism in the region has been significant at the global level. The relations between the two countries can be improved to an important level by removing economic and commercial obstacles. Farzana Shiryun, Tehran.
The EU's own agencies say 96.5 million people in the bloc are at risk of poverty. Those struggling to pay their mortgages have been given more bad news. The European Central Bank has raised interest rates for the ninth consecutive time, and a tenth increase in September is not being ruled out.
The options are on the table. To continue to hike or to hold. And we also know that it will vary meeting by meeting because we want to be determined by the data.
Fuel and electricity providers are making record profits in the EU. That's good for government tax collection, but it doesn't tell the full story. For example, on paper, the Republic of Ireland has one of the best performing economies in the Eurozone. Latest official data shows in that country a record 12,500 people, including thousands of children, are homeless. Sanctions against Russia and financial support for Ukraine are factors that continue to place enormous strain on the EU's economy. Many citizens point the finger at Washington.
What the United States decides, Europe has to follow, unfortunately. And I don't think it's the best solution to keep sending weapons.
War costs a lot. I think many, many industries are earning a lot of money thanks to the war.
We've raised these issues with the EU's executive arm, the European Commission.
We can send billions of euro to Ukraine, but is there a coordinated response in terms of the social justice problems and the cost of living crisis in the EU?
At least 15 million people, including at least 5 million children, should be lifted out of poverty by 2030. And all member states have presented their national targets to contribute to this joint ambition.
But critics of EU foreign policy suggest citizens will continue to pay a big price for many years to come. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ashura, the 10th day of the month of Muharram on the Islamic calendar, is a day when millions of Shia Muslims worldwide commemorate the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, who was martyred by forces loyal to the tyrant of the time some 14 centuries ago. Traditionally, the legacy of tragic event has been mourned inside the Muslim world, but is now spreading to new regions, including in areas where hostility towards Islam remains high. Thousands of Shia Muslims live in the UK to raise awareness among new Western audiences of Imam Hussein. Prior to the arrival of Shia Muslims, very few Danes would have even have heard of Imam Hussein's great sacrifice at Karbala all those centuries ago. Now the community faces a new challenge, not only to educate the locals about Islam, but how to effectively combat the shocking rise of aggressive anti-Islam activism from far-right activists. In this year's march, demonstrators held copies of the Quran as a peaceful response to the recent desecrations of the Holy Book by the far right, witnessed in Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. The desecration of religious sanctities is a vile practice which local authorities refuse to ban despite the great distress caused across the Islamic world.
When we talk to journalists from Danish TVs, they don't understand why we react, some of us, on a different way than just ignoring the burning. What we are afraid of is that it can start with burning the Holy Quran, it can continue with other holy scripture, but that is not what we are afraid of. We are afraid of that it would end as it did with Jews in Germany. Today we have had up to 12,000 participants, and they are growing every year, mashallah. This is one of the good things of promoting Imam Hussein, and especially his principles.
Ironically, despite becoming a hotbed of Islamophobic acts, Denmark boasts the largest Shia Muslim mosque in Europe. Local worshippers say despite the hatred shown by some individuals, many other Danes are learning more about Islam, with Imam Hussein's story central to their understanding of Islamic teachings and values. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the grain deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs. sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang.
The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
In the limelight.
Italy's economy has shrunk unexpectedly. The second half of 2023 is projected to see a sharper production drop compared to other Eurozone majors. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Italy's economy underperformed expectations in the second quarter of the year, according to data released by National Statistics Bureau, ISTAT, recently. The country's gross domestic product dropped by 0.3% quarter-on-quarter, although it was up 0.6% compared to the same period a year ago. The bleak data comes in contrast with Italian government forecast of 1% growth for the entire 2023 and a modest expansion of the economy in the second quarter. Meanwhile, economists polled by Reuters projected Italian GDP finishing the second quarter with a flat reading quarter-on-quarter and 0.9% annual growth. Franziska Palmas wrote in a report for Capital Economics seen by the news agency, "Italy is no longer outperforming its peers and we think it will experience a sharper drop in output than other Eurozone majors in the second half of 2023. ISTAT gave no numerical sector breakdown of its preliminary second quarter GDP reading, but said industrial and agriculture output decreased, whereas services grew marginally. The Bureau added that 0.3% decline left the EU's third biggest economy with so-called carryover growth of 0.8% in 2023, assuming flat growth in the remaining two quarters. Earlier this month, the government said that GDP could grow by at least 1.2% this year, citing a positive trend in services buoyed by a prospering tourism sector, and that this would manage to counterbalance a slowdown in the manufacturing. According to ISTAT, annual inflation slowed to 6.4% in July from 6.7% in June, based on EU-harmonized consumer prices, while growth in prices of food, household and personal care stood at 10.4%, broadly in line with the month before and over 50% above the overall index. Reuters also reported Italy's economy performed surprisingly poorly in the second quarter. Dava showed recently offering an uncomfortable outlook for Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni as her government tries to tackle the negative impact of high inflation. Gross domestic product GDP contracted by 0.3% on a quarterly basis between April and June and was up 0.6% year-on-year, National Statistics Bureau Istat said. A Reuters analyst survey had pointed to a flat reading quarter-on-quarter and a 0.9% yearly rise. The gloomy data makes it harder for the government to reach its stated goal of 1% growth rate this year, although the Treasury said the target is still fully within reach. Rome added it would continue to work to implement its EU-funded national post-COVID investment program and to bring inflation down. In a report for Capital Economics, Francesca Palmas wrote Italy was no longer outperforming its peers, estimating the country would experience a sharper drop in output than other Eurozone majors in the second half of 2023. The figures cast a shadow on the country's banking sector, where the top two lenders, Intesa Sanpaolo and UniCredit, recently posted much stronger than expected earnings, helped also by low or non-existent, in the latter's case, provisions against loan losses. Istat gave no numerical sector breakdown of its preliminary second quarter GDP estimate, but said industry and agriculture output decreased, whereas services grew marginally. The 0.3% contraction left Italy with so-called carryover growth of 0.8% this year, assuming GDP would be flat in the remaining two quarters. In recent weeks, the Italian government has said the economy could grow by at least 1.2% this year, arguing that a positive trend in the service sector supported by booming tourism would be enough to offset a widely expected slowdown in manufacturing activities. Lorenzo Cadongo, head of LC Marco Advisors and former chief economist at Italy's Treasury, said, "Italy is an advanced industrial country, and the weakness in industry is much more important than the tourism sector for the economy's health." Istat also said annual inflation slowed to 6.4% in July from 6.7% in June on the EU harmonized consumer prices. Annual growth in prices of food, household and personal care stood at 10.4%, broadly in line with that of the month before and over 50% higher than the overall index. To help the poorest, the government hopes to announce a deal with supermarkets and producers to control prices of essential consumer goods.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. As eviction moratoriums have expired, along with other pandemic-era protection, homelessness is on the rise in the United States. It is not uncommon to see tent cities which have sprung up in more and more cities as Americans are being priced out of the housing market. The price to rent or buy a home is getting more out of reach for many Americans. Now, this is homelessness has been climbing steadily by 6% every year since 2017. That, along with Americans' personal debt, rising food prices, and basic supplies, do not paint a rosy picture for many Americans. Well, stay with me as we're going to take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. But first, this report.
From Vermont to Texas, desperately needed coronavirus-era social programs are ending in the United States. On August 1st, many areas ended their moratoriums on debt to landlords, meaning nearly a million children are now at risk of eviction in the city of Los Angeles alone. Families have the highest risk of losing their home, while half of those saying they expect to be evicted are Black or Latino. Evictions in the United States have recently soared to reach double what they were before the pandemic.
Lost our jobs because of the pandemic, lost everything we had because of the pandemic. We found a place to live with a buddy in Cheyenne, Wyoming, but he died, and that was in March. And so we decided to come out here because we thought there would be more opportunities. We're just hoping to get jobs and get into a place to live and get a car and function. And that, so far, we've been struck out. As you can see, we're packing our bags. We're going back to Colorado.
America's decentralized model of federalism makes a nationwide approach to the evictions wave impossible. Public camping is illegal in many places, like Texas, which makes it harder for charity workers to find and help the homeless.
I had a stroke, and I was bleeding on the brain, and, you know, I had to go to rehab a lot to learn how to walk and talk again and all that. I've only been homeless like a year and a half. I went to Cornerstone Shelter, Sarah Circle Shelter, and now I'm in a tent. But I got a caseworker, I went to church, and the Cornerstone supervisor told me I popped up on a her computer and I got, you know, she's got housing for me.
Other vital social services are also being withdrawn. Millions of Americans, including children and new mothers, just lost their medical coverage for the first time in 3 years after Washington refused to extend the pandemic-era program. College tuition debt represents an incredible 7% of U.S. GDP. In October, 41 million Americans will have to start repaying an average of $400 per month, and many say this alone could push the country into a recession. A lack of affordable housing is something that any committed government can easily fix. By writing laws which favor tenants instead of rich landlords, by putting more tax revenue into building more public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight. Cecile Johnson, human rights defender and author out of Chicago. Charles Simmons, social activist, educator, and political analyst out of Detroit. Well, thank you both for being with me. Good to see both of you. Well, let me start this off in Chicago and Cecile. Cecile, what's going on? Why are we seeing this deterioration in the way we are, especially when we look at the situation of housing in the United States?
Well, poverty is an issue. Lack of affordable housing is an issue. We just came out of COVID and many of the things are going to be ending. But in reality, in Chicago, we have about, you know, 70% of those experiencing homelessness are Black people. So this is because many of the places that people live are poorer areas. You know, we are only 30% of the population in Chicago, but we are a third of the people who are, you know, suffering from poverty. And that's gone up with COVID, where a lot of people did lose jobs and other sources of income. So that's part of the squeeze.
And Charles, why are we seeing these housing prices increase in the way they are in most cities, that it makes it even difficult for people to be able to afford rent, and for sure, very difficult for them to buy?
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming.
I think it's important to put the homelessness within the context of the overall domestic crisis. We have a crisis in, and not only in housing, and let me point out that many of the people who are homeless actually are not unhoused. They are living somewhere. Many of them are living in their cars or trucks. People that have campers they're living in now. Many people they're living in the in basements of vacant buildings. So the actual the official data is very unreliable because much of the homelessness is disguised. In addition, many people who are working full time are homeless in the United States. And I've seen this for the past 30 years at least. So this is not a new phenomenon, but it is getting worse. Now, I would say I also put it within the context of other social crises, such as a crisis in healthcare, crisis in public education, because the budget for public education has steadily been declining over the past 30 years. Along with the deindustrialization of the nation. There are cuts in libraries, there are cuts in mental health facilities. We used to have mental health programs in the communities that were free, and we no longer have those. The prison population is on the rise. And I would also say that I would put a label on all of this as a war on working people in the United States. And along with the global wars that we have been involved in over, you know, continuously since World War II, that has created another level of spending that should be going to solve domestic problems. For instance, the money we spent in Afghanistan, the Afghanistan war, 20 years, trillions of dollars that we can't even count, we don't even know, but we do know that the money on the Afghan war just for a few years could pay for the and solve the housing problem in the United States. So this the housing problem is not an accident, it's an intentional problem.
Well let me just jump in right there. You said, Charles, it's an intentional problem. Why would the powers that be want to make that a problem in the country?
Well, because the real estate is a big industry, and so they don't want to build affordable housing because it's not profitable enough. It's more profitable to make expensive housing for rich people, and so the budget for low income people has just declined radically. The budget for middle income people has declined radically. So that's why I say it's not something that's necessary. And I was comparing what's happening in the United States with Cuba. I was in Cuba a couple of months ago. 85% of the population there has a family home, and evictions are illegal. And I'm talking about in a poor country. They are able to house the majority of their people in a livable environment. And we can't do it in the United States, rich country.
Well, Cecile, in 2020, it was estimated that it would take $20 billion to end homelessness in the United States. Since the start of the Ukraine war, the Biden administration has given at least $75 billion in aid or cash to Kiev. Let's talk about priorities for Washington and what is going on. How can they actually prioritize other entities first besides their own people?
Well, it's clear that there is no political will to do that, as you can see by the votes that come in, right? And yes, here's a country that has all this money to invest in war and none to invest in its people. It's not just the housing. We have a crisis in so many different areas, as the brother has pointed out. So it's about lack of priority. In Chicago, we have an example where the Ukrainians, they took a school. We have a very large homeless population, and I say 70% of them are Black. And when you look at recently, they had a school that was converted. So we had like 50 schools that were closed over a period of years, the last decade, and could have been used to house the homeless. However, it wasn't until the Ukrainian war that they bused people to Chicago and they converted a school, I think spent $15 million of our taxpayer dollars to do that. So it's not that people don't know what to do, but when it comes to us, the local people, somehow there's no political will to do
so. So let me just understand what you're saying, dig into this a little bit more. So you're saying that when Ukrainians went to Chicago, that schools were converted into housing for them?
There was a school that was converted into housing for, I think, about 150 people. And the question is, why was that same thing? Since we do have these schools that have been, you know, closed over the period of time, and many of them were in Black areas. In fact, where they were putting those people, the Ukrainian community was asking for them to be in their community, and instead they were putting them in our community. So, yes, you know, why was this a priority? You know, we have a new mayor, so we can't blame him for this problem. He's inheriting some problems, and he's tried to be more humane. However, you know, this is not rocket science. You have old schools there. They could house the homeless. You've renovated it for the Ukrainian refugees. So why not? Why couldn't you have, did the same thing for your own people within Chicago, you know, or any place else?
And you're saying, Cecile, sorry to interrupt you, and you're saying that you believe racism plays a role in all of this because you brought up some statistics at the beginning. Is there a demand? Has there been a demand from the Black community, especially when they saw the situation with Ukrainian refugees coming in and getting facilities, getting things that the Black community and perhaps others don't have? Have they demanded that the government, some government accountability for this?
Well, we've had people speaking up because with the new mayor coming in, he's been holding town halls and, you know, different meetings. And so people have been speaking up about some of these issues. But it is, I think it's racism, and not because we have now have a Black mayor, but because of a system that has been in place that has historically not paid much attention to the Black population. In Chicago, we used to be 40% of the population. We're now down to 29%. And I believe that some of these conditions are created to deliberately cause us to move out of the city. We've lost over 250,000 people, right, from 2000 to 2015. So it's probably up to like 300,000 now. So, and that's the Black population. So you're creating these conditions of hardship, which make people leave and go other places. You have housing vouchers sometimes that they sit on, you know, billions of dollars worth of housing vouchers. And then when, like the gentleman said, it's better for them to have high-rise, you know, expensive housing than affordable housing. And so you've seen a loss of affordable housing in Chicago when they got rid of some of the projects, and many of these people were then displaced all over the place. So I believe that some of that is what has also caused the homelessness. Okay. So it's about priorities.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Charles, how is it that during the last 40 years, when we look at China, it has been able to reduce extreme poverty by 800 million people, when Washington has seen an increase in poverty, when the American economy has been much bigger and much stronger than the Chinese during this time?
Well, there's an intention on the part of the Chinese to serve the needs of the people, to raise the living standard of people, of working people, family farmers in China. That does not exist here. We could do it if the government, the leadership intended to do it, it could be done. But there are, my sister Cecile raised some very important, it is a very racist issue, affecting African Americans and people of Latin descent from South America. For one of the issues is that the loans for housing, there's a high, black people end up paying more for interest rates than white people do. And that there's a process here called redlining, which divides the community in sort of an apartheid system, that certain areas on the map cannot get loans. Certain areas can get high interest loans. Other areas can get lower interest loans. It's a very racist map system that they use. We also have what's called gentrification here, in which people who are wealthier than the ordinary workers can go and buy up the property when some of the working class people get behind in their payments. And so there's a major shift over in the past 30 years of homeowners in Detroit. The racial population, African Americans, were about 80% roughly of the population in Detroit, where we have about less than 700,000 people in total. So there's the favoritism in the allocation of loans for housing, and there's a favoritism for other types of consumer loans. Now, the debt, you mentioned personal debt at the beginning. Since 1970, the real wages of workers in the United States was stagnant. In fact, it's moved backwards, so that people in 1970 actually were making more money as a working class person than they are making today. Often, the grandparents are making more real money, real wages, than the grandchildren are. So China doesn't have 800 military bases around the world either. China may have two or three. I haven't been able to find out information about more than that. But we have military bases throughout the planet, over 800. Those are like small cities. The American taxpayers had to pay for that. The working people had to pay. The rich people really pay proportionately less taxes than working class and so middle class.
Well, Cecile, do you think what we're seeing in the United States is the result of decades of neoliberalism, which, of course, prioritizes the need of the 1% to the 10% over the majority of the people?
I would say that is so, and especially now where we have this backlash on everything that has actually given or attempted to, because I don't think that we have come very far to give us any rights to move forward, right? So when you think, based on what Charles just talked about, we have, when it comes to home ownership, the rate 60 years ago was 40% for black people, and it's still 40% today. So there's been no growth in that. In Chicago, you had banks lending 12 cents on the dollar to the whole black community and the whole dollar to the white community, like four areas on the north side of Chicago. So there's definitely bias.
Still,
right?
Taking place, you're saying?
Yes, that's happening right now, right? 12 cents on the dollar, right? So you have not, when you are trying to buy a house and you're black, you have so many hoops that you have to jump through. It's like ridiculous. And we've seen cases, I heard an interview where a woman, and she was white, was trying to move into a black neighborhood to kind of, increase, just be more diverse. And the things that the bank put her through, she was going to have a two-family house, so she would have had income. That's usually a plus. And by the time they ran her through the ringer, she had to end up going somewhere else where she bought a one-family house, which was actually more expensive for her, right? So the banks do this. He's right about the redlining. It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed. So these are the things that are still happening and must be addressed. And like you say, in Chicago, I think that there's a long-term agenda to displace us. So therefore, they do make things more difficult. People lose their homes for the taxes, right? Taxes have gone up. When TIF funds are supposed to be spent in our communities, they're not. They end up being spent in areas that are already doing nicely, right? And then gentrification is real. They are slowly taking over, coming down on the south side, west side of Chicago, and taking over our communities. And yes, when you create this kind of hardship, it means that properties are cheaper for those who have money, right? Mm. So it's a never-ending cycle.
Indeed. Well, Charles, with everything that you've said and this lack of equality across the board, do you think that this will ultimately cause the downfall of neoliberalism in the United States as we see this changing world from a unipolar to a multipolar world? And we see examples of other countries and what they're doing. I mean, you talked about Cuba at the beginning of the show, or China, or so many other countries. I mean, do you think this will ultimately bring down that neoliberal system there because of the needs of the majority of the people?
I think it can go either way. It can go further to the right and become a fascist state. That's a possibility. It can also become more of a workers-oriented state, because we have right now strikes in labor organizing that's going on at a pace we haven't seen since the 1930s during the Great Depression. So young people are organizing in various jobs, professions, and it's a new type of organizing that's going on. The young folks who are organizing now are people of color. They're Black, Latino, and Asians, and they're women. So we've got a totally new type of leadership that I expect will have more of a consciousness towards serving the people in the communities as well as in their jobs. And that was something that wasn't done with our previous labor leaders, who were mostly white and skilled laborers.
So are you hopeful? Are you hopeful?
Mm-hmm. I am hopeful. I believe that the combination of the youth working for in the trade union movement, the environmental justice movement, they're working in the housing, dealing with homelessness. I see a lot of enthusiasm among young community activist leaders in a way that I haven't seen probably since the 1960s. And it's a multiracial movement now, more so than before, where it was major, in the 60s, major Black and brown movement.